Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, Al.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsors, Old School Labs and Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to another week with the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding as well as about the history of bodybuilding. And this week we got a really good interview with an old school bodybuilder from the 1970s. His name is Manuel Perry. He likes to be called Manny Perry. And Manny was one of the top amateur bodybuilders in the 1970s. He had a great physique, very tall guy, about 6'2", very aesthetic, small waist, wide shoulders, really good arms. And Manny was in the AAU Mr. America, which was the top amateur title at the time, back in 1977 and 1978. And he won also the 1977 Mr. USA contest, the AAU. And after that, he sort of quit his bodybuilding career to go into the movies, and he was a stuntman for Lou Ferrigno in The Incredible Hulk Show, the TV series. And then Manny continued his career in the movies as a stuntman and then eventually a stunt coordinator. Over the last 40 years, he's been in the business now for 40 years. He's still in the business. Actually, he's now even a director. He's working on a show right now called The Affair, which is on Showtime, and he's an assistant director on that show. So we had a really, really good, interesting conversation with Manuel Perry. You guys are really going to love this. He's got some really good old school stories. And first off, I do want to mention we are brought to you by Old School Labs, and I've been with Old School Labs for several years now. This is the supplement company that draws on the wisdom of the golden era of fitness and bodybuilding to offer unique supplements for the discerning athlete. I'm talking no proprietary blends, no artificial flavors or sweeteners, and you may have heard of their award-winning fat burner called Vintage Burn, which is the world's first muscle-preserving fat burner, or Vintage Blast, which is the world's first two-stage pre-workout. Old School Labs is the only brand that I use, trust, and associate my name with. They're the brand I use to win the Natural Mr. Universe contest, and they're also the company that sponsors Breon Ansley, who is the 2017 and 2018 Classic Physique Olympia champion, and he's also the 2018 Classic Physique Arnold Classic champion. They also sponsor 1983 Mr. Olympia Samir Banut and bodybuilding legend Tom Platz. So use the discount code LEGENDS12 and you will get 12% off your order at oldschoollabs.com, or you can go to amazon.com and make your order there. Old School Labs, supplements that make sense. All right, so how's everybody doing? We are now in our second week in December. Christmas is only 2 weeks away, if you can believe it. This year has gone by so fast. And we are now at the end of the year, sort of the holiday season right now. I think everybody's kind of winding down. There's no competitions going on. And I did my last photo shoot last Tuesday, which was December 4th. And I finally hit my peak. I did 3 photo shoots this year. And I wasn't really happy with the way I looked in the first 2. I thought I could have been leaner for the first one. And then the second one, I was a little leaner, but I thought I was a little flat. But this one, I really hit it right. I was 198, and I was full, and I was really ripped. I had that loose skin on my lower abs. I just thought it was from getting older, and I wasn't going to be able to tighten it up. But it did tighten up, believe it or not. And I really hit my peak. So gave me a lot of feedback and a lot of information. So if I want to continue to train hard and compete next year, which is what I'm planning to do, I've got a good idea about how long I'm going to have to diet. I'm going to stay a little bit leaner this time and not get as heavy. So I think that should help me when I start getting leaner and get that skin tighter also. So it was a really good experience, and I had a really good photo shoot with criticalbench.com, and I've done a lot of videos for them. So we did a few more videos and we took some good photos. So I was very happy with how it all turned out. Check out criticalbench.com's podcast, because we have that interview that I did about 6 weeks ago. I think that's coming out this week. He said it was coming out on the 10th, which is this week. So check that out, and I will give you guys the link for that next week if you can't find it. So that was a great experience, and I was really, really wiped out all week. Very tired. I think this is normal after contest is over or a photo shoot is over. You put so much into it. You're so hyped up. You're training so hard. You're cutting your calories. And then when it's over, it's like you hit that wall. And I was just wiped out all week. I didn't even work out all week. I haven't worked out since Monday. Usually I go in and do like a deload week where I just train light, but I didn't feel like doing that. I've just been sleeping a lot, and taking naps every day after work. So I think I'm finally rested up and I'm ready for the off season, which will start this week. So I'll start my power cycle week number one this week using my MP6 workout program, which, as I mentioned before, I have a book on that. If you guys are interested in learning about that, just email me at naturalolympia@gmail.com, or you can get it on amazon.com. Yeah, I am ready to go, man. I'm ready for the off season now that I'm all rested up. I had some bad news this week. One of my cousin Lori, passed away from, I believe, a heart attack. So that was a shock. She lives in Chicago, and we didn't know, nobody expected that. It was just one of those things that just happened. We think it was a heart attack, so they haven't done an autopsy yet, but that was really a shock for everybody. My condolences to my cousin Charlie and my uncle Eddie and all the people in my family who are dealing with that. And got some good news. My buddy Al Rohde came in from Chicago. He was here in St. Pete with his wife. So I got a chance to meet up with him and have dinner with him. I haven't seen him in a while. I think I've seen him. I haven't seen him in about a year. I think I saw him last Christmas. So it's always good to catch up with some old friends. You know, as you get older, time goes by faster, and you just can't get enough time. Everybody's so busy. Everybody's busy with their families and their jobs, and everybody's supposed to take time out to catch up with old friends and everything, but it never happens. So you know, I was glad I got a chance to hang out at least for one night with my good friend Al. We did have a email from last week from Ty Clifton, and he says, "Hey, John, I absolutely love your show. I'm a younger guy, 32 years old, but I have a love for history, and your show brings it to light on everything we missed out on during the golden era. It's absolutely great. It makes me realize I was definitely born in the wrong generation. I know your show revolves around bodybuilding, but have you possibly considered some old school World Strongest Man competitors as guests? It's still old school training, and it would be great to hear from greats such as the Kaz, Jeff Capes, even John Kolb, who competed and played with the Steelers. I also would love to hear from some of the Nautilus guys, such as Dr. Ellington Darden, Casey Viator, and Big John." Well, Casey has passed on. He died about 6 years ago, I believe, 2012. Dr. Ellington Darden, I'd love to talk to him. I'll try to get a hold of him. He says, "Next, my question to you is, what are your thoughts on the old school Nautilus machines? Not the Nautilus HIIT training, just the feel and the movements of the machines. I absolutely love them, and I believe they were before their time. I have several that I picked up for the gym that I own here in Oklahoma, Bombers Gym. Seems like today's equipment is more for looks and prettiness versus hard stuff that actually builds and works. Again, this is why I was born in the wrong generation. Golden era guys had some work ethic that is very rare in today's society. P.S. If you'd like to have a Bombers Gym t-shirt, let me know the size and address to send it, and I'll get one to you. Keep up the great work. I can't wait for the next podcast." Yes, I have tried Nautilus equipment. At the Powerhouse Gym, the one they had in downtown Tampa, they had a Nautilus pullover machine, which was great. And I know some of their leg machines were great. But, yeah, you're right. That equipment is very hard to come by, especially the original Nautilus equipment. But, yeah, I would love a t-shirt. I'm going to email you back so I can get a Bombers Gym t-shirt. And thank you for listening to the show. And I also want to mention that we are brought to you by our other sponsor, which is Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff that will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results you've been looking for. They offer a wide range of services that ensure you will not only look and feel amazing, but also be comfortable knowing that they're there for you every step of the way. Their competitive pricing, along with their quality products and services, are just a few reasons to give them a call. So call them at their office number out here in Tampa, Florida, at 813-922-8939, and they will work with anybody in the continental United States. Again, their number is 813-922-8939. Or you can reach them at their website, which is flalternativemeds.com. Again, FL for Florida, alternativemeds.com. And tell them that you heard their ad on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, and they will give you a free consultation. They'll also give you 20% off your first order. All right, that is our opening for the show, and here is our great interview we had with Manuel Perry. I really enjoyed this one. Check it out. All right, welcome back to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, and I have a very special guest this week. His name is Manuel Perry, and Manuel was one of the top amateur bodybuilders in the 1970s. He won the tall class at the Mr. America contest 2 years in a row, and now he has a very successful career in the movies as a stunt coordinator. Manuel, welcome to the show. It's great to talk to you.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. You can address me as Manny.
All right.
Manny would be okay. Fine.
All right, Manny. That's good. I grew up, Manny, reading the bodybuilding magazines in the 1970s. You were one of the top guys when I first started reading the magazines, because I think I got into it in 1977, and I know that was a big year for you. Yep. So if you could take us back to the beginning and just tell us how you got into bodybuilding, what attracted you to lifting weights and then eventually competing?
I was just like most kids do in high school or whatever. You start lifting weights to try to get stronger for sports.
Mm-hmm.
And I was playing football. I was wrestling. And I played all sports. I come from a small town in Massachusetts called Plymouth, Mass.
Okay.
Where the Pilgrims landed and the Mayflower.
Yeah. Right.
So my wrestling coach decided, well, let's go to a gym over the summer and, you know, put a few pounds on, get stronger, and so on and so forth.
Okay.
So the next town over was a town called Duxbury, Massachusetts,
mm-hmm.
where the gym owner, Bob Backus, he was friends with my wrestling coach. And Bob Backus was an Olympic hammer, a medalist, and I think it was the 54 Olympics.
Okay.
So we went to his gym, and that was the first time I was exposed to a real gym.
Mm-hmm.
So typically, at high school, you had that one, at that time, it was called a universal, one piece of apparatus that you could do everything on.
Yeah, I remember those, yeah.
Yeah. So when we went to Bob Backus's gym, he had teamed up with just a new piece of equipment that came out with Arthur Jones' design called the Nautilus.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And each body part was isolated with each piece of equipment. So needless to say, started working out, whether it was leg extension, curls, pull downs, long pulls, and my body just started changing over the course of 3 or 4 or 5 months.
Okay.
There was a couple bodybuilders that worked out at the gym. One's name was Len Archibald.
I remember him, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the other guy was Barry Blennis. They were the two top bodybuilders that worked out in that area that worked out at this gym. I really didn't know much about bodybuilding. I picked up a few magazines and looked down and, wow, that'd be great to look like that, but I wasn't really focusing myself on bodybuilding.
Okay.
So during the time I worked out at the gym, the guys, well, who are you? You're a new face. We don't know who you are. Who are you? I said, well, I'm from the next town over. They asked me if I was competing. I said, no, I wasn't competing. So they said, well, you look like you've got a pretty good foundation. Perhaps you should think about, you know, entering a contest. Not really. I wasn't interested in it. And then as I started to change my body, they kept on encouraging me. So I decided, well, I'll give it a try. So I entered my first contest and I took third place.
Okay. Which show was that, Manny?
It was a small competition in Massachusetts. I don't remember what title it was. It was just, you know, just a little local show around the Boston, Connecticut area.
Yeah.
And then I decided, this is kind of cool, kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So then it gave me a little goal to try to achieve. I started working out as a trainer with Len Archibald. And my body started changing. And then I started competing a little bit more. And I kind of won a lot of the competitions on the East Coast, Connecticut, went to New York a couple times.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 1973, I think it was 73, I went to the Olympia at the Brooklyn Academy of Music in New York.
Oh, cool. Nice.
And there was Arnold, there was Franco, there was Bray, there was Sergio wasn't there, but there were Bill Grant and Robbie Robinson. But these were some of the top guys.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I finagled my way into get into the backstage. Where everybody was pumping up. And then that was the first time I realized, oh my God, this is what I want to look like.
Yeah, and that's cool.
Gave me the bug to, you know, I'm going to train hard. I'm going to go to California. I'm going to try to, you know, get out there with the big boys so I could learn as much as I possibly could about training techniques and dieting and stuff.
Yeah.
So I decided to move to California and train at Gold's Gym, the original Gold's Gym.
Yeah. How old were you, Manny, when you did that?
I was probably 23, 24.
Okay.
And when I got to California, it was like 6 o'clock in the morning, and I was trying to find Gold's Gym. I ended up finding it. I knocked on the front door, opened the door. It was locked, but I could hear the weights clanging, and all the glass windows were all steamed up. You couldn't see inside, but I knew they had to get in somewhere. I went around the back. I went around the back alley. The door was open. Walked up inside. And there, I remember when I walked in, there was Arnold training.
Really? Wow,
and
that's cool.
And it was like, and he had, you know, no shirt on, just a pair of, you know, gym shorts.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I thought I saw God.
Wow, I mean, that's so awesome.
There was the Austrian Oak, you know, big pecs hanging off, big back, big arms, big calves.
Wow.
Franco was in there. Dave Draper was in there. Frank Zane was in there. Robbie Robinson was in there. Denny Gable. I mean, the list goes on. And Ken Waller. It goes on and on.
Wow. Unbelievable.
I got intimidated and ran out.
Oh, my God.
I'll never forget that moment ever.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So what year was that, Manny?
That was probably 70. It was probably early on in 70. See, I won the USA in 77. That was probably 70. Yeah, late 75, because we had the Mr. America bicentennial year competition in Santa Monica.
76.
It was a late 75 or early 76.
Okay. Wow. What a great story. That's awesome.
Yeah, great story. So then I joined the gym and started training, and I was encouraged, well, maybe you should go to a competition. And my first contest was Mr. Venice Beach.
Okay, yeah,
which we have here every year with Joe Wheatley Productions puts it on.
Right.
So I said, well, I'm going to start at a small competition because the guys that were everyday training, they looked like they could win competitions all day and all night. So I didn't want to take too big of a bite. So I said, I'm going to enter a small contest, Mr. Venice Beach, which my main competitors were Andreas Colling, Swedish bodybuilder, and God rest his soul, Bill Pettit.
Yeah.
Basically, it wound down to us three.
Okay.
The competition, and I was fortunate enough to win.
Wow. Okay, cool.
And I felt like, well, I'm in California. I won my first competition in California, so I felt pretty good about myself.
Yeah, for sure.
And
now, what did your physique look like at this point, Manny? Because I remember you had the really good arms when you were competing.
Well, my main body parts that always were, I think, regarded as, you know, very good was my calves.
Okay.
Typically, African American bodybuilders generally don't have good calves.
Right.
It's a genetic thing for African American. I'm Portuguese. Both of my parents were born in Portugal, and they came over to this country. But you know, my ancestry, Cape Verdean Islands, is where my parents are from.
Mm-hmm.
That was a part of Portugal years ago, but it broke off and became little island. So there's black heritage in my background, but my heritage, my mother and father's side, are both Portuguese.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
So I had some fairly good genetics. My grandmother was, you know, She had good legs and, you know, somewhat good calves for a female. And I mean, I worked my calves very hard, and they grew. And my arms just grew as well. I mean, my arms at the best was 23 1/4.
Wow.
The biggest my arm was, I mean, it was, you know, I was bulked up at that point, but still, that's almost right. 24 inch arm.
Yeah, right. That's huge, especially for back then.
I mean, it was crazy. I mean, I remember the first 20-inch arm was Leroy Colbert.
Yeah, yeah.
Black actor. I mean, a black athlete. Well, he had, you know, the 20-inch arm on the cover of you know, Muscle, Dan LaRue
sure.
magazine.
Right, right.
So, then, you know, I started realizing, well, if I'm going to be, I got to start working on my other body parts to try to catch up.
Yeah.
But when you have a when you have a body part that's naturally, you know, like Tom Platz, for instance, I'll just pull Tom out of the archives because Tom is, I mean, legendary legs.
Yeah.
Even by today's standards.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Absolutely.
But no matter what Tom did, he could not get his upper body to match his lower body.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that's just, you know, a genetic. I mean, he was gifted with humongous quads. He worked them very hard, and they just grew for him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I said, I got to get my chest up, my back up, my hamstring, my quads. And I, you know, worked out as hard as I could, like all the other guys did.
Uh-huh.
My calves and arms with my body parts that I would always win best arms in a competition.
And, yeah.
So needless to say, when I would be posing, I feature my arms a lot of my
right.
job.
Right. So what was it like to train at Gold's Gym? I want to hear some of those stories because that had to be amazing. You were at the original Gold's Gym in the middle 70s. So that had to be like, that was really the golden era of bodybuilding.
It was the golden era. Like I say, the top, I guess, if there, let's just say the top 20 bodybuilders, the top 15 or 16 are trained at Gold's.
Yeah.
And when you walked in that gym, the electricity was like nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
You just felt like you could train hard. You could do what you couldn't do prior because the energy was so high in Gold's. So look around and see the top bodybuilders in the world next to you, training with you, doing long pulls, doing chins, doing squats right next to you. It was an amazing time. And that one, at that time, bodybuilding was, you know, just, I call it, well, you called the golden era, and I agree with you. That was an era that will never be recreated again.
No, it'll never be recreated. You're right.
It'll never be that way again. You know, it was the timing, the era, the time, and
yeah.
all the guys would train together. We'd go to this little restaurant. It was called German's. It was a little restaurant in Venice where all the guys would go. We'd get, you know, 6-egg omelet, 2 big beef patties, omelet, scrambled egg, whatever you wanted, protein-wise. We'd all go, you know, train, go to the restaurant, have lunch or breakfast. Then everybody would go to the beach. Everybody would go to the beach and hang out for a couple hours, get some sun, get in the water, and then wait for your afternoon session to go back to the gym. It was bodybuilding lifestyle. That's what it was.
Yeah. Now, did you have a job at this time, Manny?
I worked at a bar restaurant in Malibu called the Crazy Horse Saloon, which I was a bartender bouncer. $100 a night, and all I could eat.
Okay.
So I would go there, and I would make my ice cream, half and half, 6 eggs, protein powder I would take and make a giant, giant smoothie. And I'd go and have 3 or 4 chicken breasts, or make scrambled egg omelets or whatever I could eat. And that's how I survived. And we had this couple of companies that would do concerts, like they call them rave concerts today, where you go in the middle of a field and somebody put up music and they play music. A bunch of kids would go and have fun. Well, we would go and be security.
Mm-hmm.
And I make a few bucks doing that. And whatever else, sometimes people would hire me to work security at like a party or a gathering or some kind of an event, and I pick up a few bucks. But my main focus was I gotta get to the gym and train.
Who were the guys that you hung around with at Gold's back then? Because I know Ken Sprague owned it right around that time, right?
Ken Sprague owned the gym, and Ken Sprague and his wife Marion were the two that encouraged me to go to Arlington, Texas, to compete in the Mr. USA competition.
Okay.
I wasn't sure if I was ready myself personally, but they felt I was ready. Mm-hmm. And they talked me into it, and I said, okay. So I went into a training mode, and I trained with Robbie Robinson for that competition.
Yeah. Wow.
And I trained like I had never trained before.
Uh-huh.
Robbie is an animal in the gym.
You're right.
And we did things I've never done before with supersetting and, the weights we handled, the exercises, the movements.
Yeah.
And worked because I went to Arlington, Texas, and I won. I won the,
you won the
heavyweight division and won the overall.
Yeah. And you beat Dave Johns, who would become Mr. America next year. Yeah.
Yeah, I beat Dave Johns. I beat a guy named Baldwin. I beat C.F. Smith and a few other guys who were pretty good bodybuilders. I can't remember all of the names because at that point, I was just so nervous just at that level of competition, which I wasn't sure if I would, be able to dethrone or win the competition. And I ended up walking away with the title. So.
Wow, amazing.
That was a very, very high point for me.
Like you said, you trained with Robbie, and you guys did things you never did before, supersets, heavier weights. Were you training like everybody was back then, 6 days a week, twice a day?
Probably 6 days a week. Monday morning, it was Monday, Wednesday, Friday. Start off with calves. Mm-hmm. We were two major body parts. Monday, Wednesday, Friday, be chest and back.
Okay.
In the morning. Then we go eat, hang out at the beach, come back in the afternoon around four-ish, and do legs.
Wow.
Then Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, start off with calves, and we'll be shoulders and arms.
Okay.
And then we would end each session every day with abs.
Wow. How long were those workouts?
Hour and a half, 90 minutes.
And
then legs would be a separate because it's too big of a body part to work with any other body part.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Robbie was an animal in the gym. I mean, we would just pound on the weights and squat rack, front squats, back squats, hack squats. The leg press machine. I mean, stuff that I never used because I never had that equipment when I was coming up.
Yeah. How did you like California after living in Massachusetts?
I love California. I mean, I call it year-round summer.
Yeah, yeah.
We have a couple weeks of rain in the winter and people are freaking out. Oh, it's winter. I said, winter? This is nothing.
Right.
It's like a shower for a couple of weeks.
Yeah. Who are some of the other guys that you trained with it or hung around with at Gold's? I know Ken Waller was around at that time, right?
Kenny Waller, my hobby was kind of hot rod cars.
Okay.
I'm pretty good with my hands building. I know how to weld. I know how to do machine work. I operate heavy equipment. I'm mm-hmm. versed in a lot of areas because my uncles and friends always had some kind of a equipment that needed to be rebuilt or fixed. My uncle owned heavy equipment company. I learned how to run a bulldozer when I was 10 years old, drive truck,
wow.
trip, run a crane, I can run a backhoe. So actually when I first got signed up with Gold's gym, Joe Gold, he built all the equipment himself. He was a machinist.
Right.
So he built all the equipment and that's how Joe's name got so famous because he built his machines that would isolate your arms or your back, lat pull machine, the creature bench, or whatever equipment, whatever piece of equipment that you needed to isolate a body part. Joe made equipment for that body part. That's when everybody was going to Gold because there was no other equipment that could, give you the results that Joe's equipment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I would talk to Joe about, the weight, because he'd ask me, he says, well, I weld. And I said, well, I know how to weld. Well, I have a lathe. I know how to run a lathe. He makes the equipment. He put the knurling on the bars where you grip with your hands.
Hmm.
He would make
wow.
the spinning, the plates, the collars. I know how to do all that stuff. So he took me over to his shop in Inglewood, and him and Dan Howard, who was, he actually was a football coach, but he worked out at the gym, not a bodybuilder, but just worked out, and he managed the gym. So we became friends, and we started talking shop. So Joe took me under his belt, and I helped him with some of the equipment, making some of the equipment, carrying it from his workshop to the gym. So he said, well, you know what? You don't have to pay membership. You train here for free.
Wow.
That's a cool story with Joe Gold.
Yeah. How was Joe? He was a no-nonsense kind of guy, right?
Oh, no-nonsense. I mean, if you clang weights in the gym, you get one warning. The second warning, you're out.
Mm-hmm.
The rack, if you use your dumbbells to do curls,
yeah.
When you your set, you didn't put them back on the rack, one warning, you're out.
Wow.
Squat rack, if you put 45-pound plates on and you slip another plate on and you slam them together, one warning, then you're out.
Wow.
Old school, hardcore, and did not want anything to do with women in the gym.
Oh, really? Huh. He was real old
weightlifting,
school.
Weightlifting was for men, not
old. And there was no music in the gym either, right?
No music.
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, early on there was no music, but later on, music, because you know, as the gym got more popular, more people started coming from all over the country, the world. You had guys from Germany and Spain and Uruguay, and you know, guys from all over the world coming to Gold's. Because they want to train with all the big boys.
Right, right.
Then music started to come into the picture. I remember one specific song that Robbie Robinson, myself, and I got to be good friends with a guy that was a little bit ahead of me, but up and coming. His name was Denny Gable.
Mm-hmm.
And we all trained. We trained together as a threesome.
Okay.
And a boss Skag song called Dirty Lowdown.
Yeah, I remember that song.
That was a great song. And when that song came on in the morning, goosebumps came upon my arms, and you felt like you could get 10 pounds more on whatever exercise you were doing, and you could handle it. It was just, the whole era of training with those guys, that gym, the music, it was quite an exciting and a memorable time for me.
Like magical, right?
Ken Waller and I became good buddies because I had a Corvette. Kenny worked on Corvettes. We were mechanically inclined, so we could talk shop together about motors and cams and carburetors and headers and all that stuff. So we became friends, and Kenny was really strong in the gym as well, really strong.
Yeah, yeah. Did you hang out with a lot of those guys too, like go out to the – well, you worked at a club, but did you go out to clubs with them?
No. Yeah, we'd go out to clubs. We'd go out to the local clubs. Me and Denny and Lawler and, you know, pets hanging out, traps hanging out, shirts rolled up. We'd get on the dance floor and we would own the club.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a special. Music was playing. We'd be on the dance floor. We'd go into our posing routines. People would drop out. What the hell is this?
Right, right.
Just having a good old time with each other. We had fun.
Yeah. How did the women like bodybuilders back then in the 70s? Because you guys had to be like really unique, you know, if you had in the discos and stuff, you had to really stand out.
They would hang all over you.
Really?
they never seen stuff like that, you know.
Right, right, yeah.
You know, guys come in with it, you know, you're back then, where, you know, you open your shirt up to your chest, a couple of buttons undone, maybe a short sleeve shirt on, forearms, veins popping, traps popping.
Right.
Hanging. You walk into a club and it's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. The girls are like, yeah, I want to get with them.
Yeah. All right, the good old days, huh?
I remember going to a club in Redondo Beach, California. It was called the Red Onion. They were a popular chain of clubs. And we're dancing. And I remember I had on a Hawaiian shirt that was kind of cut short on the sleeves. I had a gold chain. Afro was working. The gold chain was working. And that night, for some reason, there was someone that worked for Playboy magazine at the club. They did a couple of photographs of me, which I didn't know. A couple of photographs while I was on the dance floor, getting my groove on.
Mm-hmm.
And someone had called the gym and said, there's a little article about this bodybuilder. We're not sure who he is, but we assume he trained at Gold's Gym. They called Ken Keen, who was a bodybuilder back in the 70s.
Yeah, I remember Ken Keen. Mm-hmm.
Well, he said, that photo is a manual. And then the next edition, I've got the article somewhere in my archive. There's a little picture of me on the dance floor. One little corner of the magazine. And I got to make an article in Playboy magazine.
Wow. That's cool.
Pretty cool.
Yeah. I like too back then, you know, because there was no internet or anything. So if anybody wanted to know anything, they had to call the gym, right?
You had to call the gym, or you had to drive to the gym if you wanted to see. Otherwise, in the magazine. But if you weren't, you know, the top guys, you weren't getting in the magazine.
Right. That was Waller to hang out with at the club. Oh, I heard he was pretty wild, huh?
Kenny was wild. I mean, you know, we'd go out and we'd be having a good time. If anybody wanted to start some shit, you didn't want to start it with Kenny because he would answer your call.
Right. That's what I heard about him.
He played Kentucky football. He was tough. He was, I mean, nice guy. Don't get me wrong. He was a perk. But, you know, if you wanted to rumble, there's a chip on his shoulder. Just knock it off and you'll have your rumble. But a real cool guy.
That's what Bill Grant told me, the same thing.
Oh, yeah. Well, Grant. I saw Bill when I went to the Brooklyn Academy of Music. I went backstage. I saw Bill Grant and Bill's physique, you know, he had a memorable physique. He was very, very muscular. Mm-hmm. And his abs were just like, you know, clear cut six pack, deep abs. So I talked with him a little bit and I said, well, I'm from Massachusetts. I'm going to go to California. But he goes, well, when you come to California, look me up. You know, just being a nice guy from a young bodybuilder that, you know, wanted to try to make something of myself as a bodybuilder. He said, you come to California, look me up. So when I went to California, I looked him up and there he was at the gym. And I have to say it, Bill was so nice to me. He treated me almost like I was family. I trained with him. He said he worked at LAX, Los Angeles International Airport.
Right.
His job was he'd go, when the passengers would get off the plane, they'd go in there and they would clean all, you know, the leftover papers and magazines, napkins, whatever. That was his job. He would clean the planes.
Right.
And that's how he made his money. He said, well, Manny, you could take me to work in the morning and use my car all day and pick me up at night.
Wow. Amazing.
And I was like, wow. Yeah. You go to the gym. He said, you want to take a shower? Here's my keys. And I go to work. You can come take a shower. Take a nap. I got some food in the fridge. He treated me like I was his relative. And I never forgot that. And I thank Bill till to this day. I've had him on a couple movie sets with me.
Oh, really?
Working as an actor. We did one episode. I imagine you know that I used to be the stunt double for Lou Ferrigno.
Yeah, for The Incredible Hulk.
Yeah. Well, we had an episode where the storyline was Lou's dad owned a pizzeria, and the pizzeria was going out of business because they couldn't have any money. Lou entered a local competition to try to win the first place prize, which was money, to keep the doors open for the gym. Keep the doors open for the restaurant.
Right.
So the producers came to me and said, Manny, we know you know some guys, so we're going to have a Mr. Galaxy competition that Louie's going to win, but we need some guys to train at the gym and from some guys to compete against Louie where Louie was going to win. Mm-hmm. I had Roger Callard. I had Denny Gable. I had Bill Grant, Rick Drayson.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. A couple other guys. We're all training, you know, as the scene came where they came in the gym and talked to Lou. We're all training in the background. And I had those guys all all guys from the gym come in to play bodybuilders in the gym that we filmed at.
Wow, that's cool.
So that was pretty cool to, you know, throw a little love to some of the bodybuilders.
Right. Before we talk about some of your stunt work and how you got into the movies, I want to talk more about your bodybuilding. You said you won that Mr. USA in 1976, and then in 77, as we were saying, they had it in Santa Monica, and that was a huge Mr. America contest where they had Mae West and they had the parade with all the elephants and everything, and that was a very tough show, and you won the tall class in that, too.
I won the tall class heavyweight division. At that time, the Incredible Hulk, we were in, I believe, halfway through our first or second season.
Oh, so you were already working for the Incredible
Hulk. Yeah, I was working. Because after I had won the Mr. USA, mm-hmm. I did a movie called Kentucky Fried Movie.
Oh, yeah, I remember that. I remember that movie.
I was a character, Big Jim Slade.
Yeah, right.
And Louis was training for the Olympia, mm-hmm. and I was training for the Mr. America. And then when they got wind of this bodybuilder named Manny Perry, they were trying to find a stunt double for Ferrigno. But, you know, I was one of the bigger bodybuilders back in that time.
Right.
And they couldn't find any stunt person that was big that could, you know, be a double for Ferrigno. So they went into the gyms trying to find, we got to find a bodybuilder.
Yeah.
So I was fresh off of the competition win. I was in shape. I was cut. They saw me and they went like, whoa, this is the guy. But
yeah,
I was an unknown. I was black. Ferrigno was white. But mm-hmm. so many people don't realize when they say, well, how could you do stunts for a white guy? You're black. Then I tell them, stop and think a moment. What color is the Hulk?
Right.
And then everybody stops and goes, oh, my God, you're right.
Right.
Ta-da!
Now, how tall are you, Manny? You're like 6'2", at least, right?
6'3", well, I'm a little shrunk up a little bit now, but I was 6'2.5", 6'3". Louis was probably 6'4.5", a little bit taller.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But the physiques were close.
Yeah, I didn't know you were already doing the Hulk thing in 77, but you're right. I mean, that's when it started, right? 1977. Yeah, exactly. That's when they did the first movie.
Yeah. Exactly. That's when we started. And everybody that watched the show goes, well, we can tell it was you because your calves are bigger than Louis.
Yeah. Yeah, because I remember Lou was in great shape that year, and he was training for the Olympia. And then right before the Olympia, they gave him that job, or they offered him the Hulk thing, and he dropped out of the contest.
Well, they offered it to Schwarzenegger,
mm-hmm.
but Arnold didn't want to do it. He was
set
on doing movies and not TV.
Okay.
I'll give you a little history, which is something that you're probably unaware of, but it's a little history. You remember the TV show? Remember the TV show called The Munsters?
Yeah, sure.
Remember the character who played Lurch?
Uh-huh.
The guy, the big
guy. Yeah, yeah.
Well, about 7'1", or something. Yeah, just really a tall guy.
Yeah.
When they came up with the idea, the pilot for The Incredible Hulk, they used him as the Hulk. He was the guy that did the TV pilot for the Hulk.
Oh, okay.
And then the series got picked up. And then the producers went, and the network said, well, you know, we feel that this character, Carradine was his name, he's not really a menacing type that would be convincing as being the Incredible Hulk. Because you look at mm-hmm. Hulk magazines, and the Hulk is a Hulk, big muscle bulging all over the place.
Right, right.
That's when they went out and try to offer it. They figured, well, we need somebody with some real muscle. You know, let's go after Arnold Schwarzenegger. He's the world top bodybuilder, and you know he's bulging all over with muscles. So we'll offer it to him. And Arnold says, I don't want to be a part of it. I want to do a movie, not TV.
Right.
So Ferrigno at that time had just come to California because Weider sent for him to come to California because they were looking for the next Arnold.
Right.
Arnold now was starting to slowly go away from competition and become a movie star. So Joe Weider wanted to find the next, you know, next guy. There were guys, there was Waller, there was, you know, the local guys, but he wanted somebody that was like outstanding.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And Rico was, you know, Louis was like 300 and something pounds when he was 18 years old. He just cleaned house on every competition on the East Coast.
Yeah.
So Rick Wayne, who used to be a top bodybuilder, worked for Weider. If you went into Weider's office, in Woodland Hill, when you first walked in, there was a life-size poster, and it wasn't of Franco, it wasn't of Arnold, it wasn't of anybody, it was Rick Wayne.
Really?
Rick Wayne became one of Joe Wheeler's favorite bodybuilders and started working for the company. So Rick Wayne went to New York and brought Ferrigno to California to start competing under Joe Wheeler's banner.
Okay. I didn't know that.
Yeah. So a lot of people don't because they just don't know the history.
Yeah.
So he started working out. We all worked for Joe Wheeler's facility in Woodland Hills where we would, you know, get the pack the vitamins, pack them in the storage room, get the weights, put them over here ready to ship out to customers all over the world.
So you actually worked in Joe Wheeler's building?
Yeah, we worked for Wheeler at his building in Woodland Hills. I mean, we didn't get paid much, but, you know, yeah. We got our protein powder, we got our vitamins, all the stuff we needed for our body to grow.
Right. Huh.
So Ferrigno started working out, and then, I think his first Mr. Olympia, you know, Arnold was like a man, and Louis was not like a child. I don't want to discredit Louis, but he was young, and, you know, he had a lot of potential, but trying to dethrone Arnold was like almost impossible.
Right.
Louis did a good job on stage with Arnold, but it was like a man against a boy, if you understand what I say.
Sure.
I mean,
yeah.
I say that.
Yeah.
He never competed at that level. I mean, you're trying to dethrone the world's top bodybuilder. Pretty tough.
Yeah.
But he made a good showing of himself at the Olympia. I have to say it. Louis looked phenomenal.
Yeah. I think a lot of people don't realize how young Louis was back then. I mean, he's only in his early 20s.
Like 26 or 27. There's a big gap in there.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, those years are critical years for body growth and development.
Yeah. I sort of wish, I think he made the right move being the Hulk, but I sort of wish he would have did the Olympia that year because I know he was in great shape that year, and I always wonder how he would have did, you know?
Louis could never beat Arnold.
Right.
In my opinion, that's my opinion. I mean, I've seen Louis in his best shape, Louis and Arnold's best shape. Actually, the best shape Louis was ever in was after he stopped competing at the Olympia. Then he came back for over 50 or senior division.
Yeah, the Masters, yeah.
The Masters, where Robbie Robinson beat him out.
Right. But I was just saying, in 77, I would have loved to have seen Lou go into the Olympia when Frank Zane won it. You know, I wonder how he would have
did. I think he would have beaten. Frank was very difficult to beat because Frank didn't have anything outstanding, but he was complete. He was complete, and he was, you know, bodybuilding is a visual thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's aesthetics. And Frank, like I say, had nothing outstanding, but he put him on a pedestal. Like Steve Reeves, he had everything. He had calves, he had quads, he had hamstring, he had abs, and he had that iconic vacuum pose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
With both hands behind your head in a vacuum, and nobody could do that.
No.
Even till today, nobody could. There's two poses that are irreplaceable. Was the double hand behind the head vacuum for Frank Zane? And Sergio Leiva double hands overhead.
Yeah.
Those two poses, any bodybuilder that I've ever seen, I don't care, Ronnie Coleman, Flex Wheeler, nobody can do those poses.
Yeah.
They can compete with those two guys.
Yeah, talk about iconic poses, right?
Oh, my God. I mean, even Arnold with his double arm, that was a great pose. But, to me, the best arm ever in the bodybuilding world was Robbie Robinson.
Mm-hmm.
Arguably, maybe, but the best arm. I'm talking the size of his wrist, the forearm, the size of his elbow, the peak on the bicep, the belly on the tricep. It was almost perfect.
Perfect, right, yeah. Even his whole front double bicep pose was just unbelievable. He has one of the best front double biceps ever.
It's sick. And the last time out, and
the small waist, the big legs.
The key for me, double bicep from the front, a lot of guys look good. But when you spin them 180 and then the double bicep, the peak on the bicep from the back, it's very few guys are very impressive from the back double bicep when you look at the arm. Robbie was almost equally as good from the back as he was from the front.
Yeah, that's true. Did you ever get a chance to meet Arnold? Did you ever get to know him?
Oh, I used to hang out with Arnold. We'd go
really
absolutely. We'd go hang out. Arnold wasn't too much of a guy because, you know, he had that accent and he was a little shy. And plus, I mean, he was a top guy. He doesn't want to hang around with those, you know, peon guys. But I mean, you know, I'd go out with him. I'd go out with Waller and, Dan Howard. We'd go out to different places. But Arnold was more or less, he was kind of more into himself. Not meaning negative, but he wasn't a guy that would go out with the rest of the guys, hang out.
Oh, really? Okay.
No, he would, you know, he would kind of, you know, hang out by himself or whatever he did in his personal life. You know, I'm not sure, but, you know, us guys would all, let's get in somebody's van and let's go to the Red Onion. Let's go have a good time. Arnold wouldn't be there. Arnold wouldn't be
there. Okay. Yeah.
But I mean, that's cool.
Yeah. Were you, really shocked when he became big later on, like 10 years later when he was in the 80s, when he was a big movie star?
I wasn't shocked because Arnold was always special.
Mm-hmm.
He had that it factor. He came to the country. He couldn't speak English. He was broke. He's talking about, I want to become a movie star. And I forgot what famous actor almost laughed at him and said, look, you're big. You can't speak English. You're a bodybuilder. You don't know anything about acting. What are you talking about? You want to become a famous movie star? You're a joke. Well, Arnold is the type of guy that he sets his goal, and 9 times out of 10, he will achieve that goal.
Mm-hmm.
He became, first of all, the top bodybuilder in the world. Okay. He became movie star, the first movie star to gross $1 billion with movie and merchandise.
Right.
Not Tom Cruise. Well, these guys are after Arnold, but you know, I mean, the guys that were Cary Grant, Sean O'Connor, all those guys. Those guys never grossed the kind of money that Arnold could with his cartoons and the figurines for Terminator, character Terminator. Then he became a real estate tycoon, owned almost all of Venice. Married into the Kennedy Shriver royalty.
Right.
Became the governor.
Mm-hmm.
And I've said it, if Arnold was born in the United States, he may not have won, but he would have been a force to be reckoned with a Republican Party running for the presidency.
Oh, I believe that too. Absolutely. No doubt about it. Yeah.
That's how popular he was when it was, I'll be back.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, for sure.
Everybody was saying that. Arnold was like this, you know, this Terminator character, the top bodybuilder, you know, the Australian oak, the chiseled jaw, the big, you know, go on Johnny Carson's show and talk about what it's like to feel a pump and orgasm. And people are like, what?
Yeah, right.
What is unbelievable. That all about?
Yeah.
I mean, he could get away with shit nobody else could get away with. He was the man.
Right. I know.
He was the man.
Yeah, and there's really nobody, there's never been anybody like him since, you know. No bodybuilder has done what he's done.
And they never will be.
No, I agree with you. There never will be. He's one in a million. Yeah.
Absolutely.
So what were your feelings in that 77 America, Manny, when you won the tall class and you beat a lot of great guys, and then Dave Johns won the overall? That was a really special event because they had a lot of press coverage. I think Ken Sprague was promoting that show, and they had, like I said, the big parade down the street with the elephants, down Main Street with the elephants and everything. That was a really unbelievable Mr. America contest.
It probably, other than something like the Olympia by today's standards, that show was way, way, way ahead of anything ever been demonstrated before for bodybuilding. Yeah. I don't care where or what competition. This was the creme de la creme when it came to competition as far as putting on an event.
Mm-hmm.
We had elephants, we had giraffes, we had floats. I flew my parents in, my mother, my dad had passed away, my mother, my aunt, my uncle, my brother, my sister. Ken Sprague put them in the limousine. They rode in the limousine, old, like a 46 Hudson with a convertible top down, my parents riding through Main Street, floats, the elephants. It was like something, it was like a circus coming into town.
Yeah, unbelievable.
Unbelievable. I was in tip-top shape. I was the best that I could be.
Yeah.
I beat Dave a while before that in the Mr. USA competition. I know Dave was going to be in my tough competition. This young kid, Ron Tufel, was coming on track. He was young. He was muscular, and he was good-looking. He was favorite. He was young, had great abs. Body was, kind of okay. Kind of, few body parts, not up to speed. But he was very popular. He just won a lot of competitions, and he was favorite. I mean, he beat Tom Platz that year.
Yeah, he won the short class, right?
Won the short class. Dave won the medium class. I won the heavyweight. I was not 100%. Even if I was 100%, I may not have won the overall. Mm-hmm. Remember, I had only been training for 4 or 5 years.
Wow, Dave, really?
I trained mid 70s, early 70s is when I started really training and competing hard on the East Coast.
Yeah, yeah.
And I came to California in 75 or 76, and I won Mr. America in 77, 78.
Yeah, yeah.
So I didn't have 10, 12, or 15 years of training under my belt.
Mm-hmm.
I had a good foundation, a good base. So I built upon that. And, Dave Johns had been training for, 15, 16 years as a, and I was very happy when I beat him in Arlington. I was like, wow. I shook his hand. I said, Dave, it's an honor to compete with you. He calls me, Big Manny. He called me Big Manny. And I think that I had, in my opinion, I looked at the photos. I'm one, when I think I should win, I think I should win, whether I did or didn't. When I think I should win, I think I shouldn't win, whether people think I should or shouldn't. I'm honest.
Right. Right, right.
That year, Dave should have beaten me.
Okay.
And he did.
Well, some of our younger listeners may not remember your physique, Manny, but I remember it. And I remember there was a picture of you in one of the Muscle Builder magazines, and you were doing cable crossovers, and you were holding the cables above your head. And I think you had swimming trunks on in the gym. And you just had this unbelievable V taper. It just looked incredible because you had the big arms. You were standing up and you were getting ready to do the cable crossovers. And you just had this incredible V taper from the wide shoulders down to the small waist. And I remember I just started bodybuilding. I was 14 years old and I showed my mom that picture and she goes, wow, he doesn't even look human.
It's funny.
One of the greatest pictures.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate that. I'm very proud of that photo. I have that photo in my phone, and I have a photo of Arnold. We're doing the same movement.
Oh, really?
The same cable crossovers with arms fully extended out, ready to start the movement.
Yeah.
And I have so many people tell me, oh, my God, you look way better than Arnold.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that was an okay. amazing picture. Now this is the caveat. Okay, I looked great in that photo. I have to say so myself. I looked great in that photo, and Arnold looked great in that photo. But I could not stand next to Arnold on stage. I'm honest about it.
Yeah.
Some pictures capture you in the light that looks, wow, that's unbeatable.
Yeah.
And I'm honest. That photo makes me look as good as, I guess. When they say you look better than Arnold, that's that's a big credit to me because I know I'm not as good as Arnold. I know. I'm honest with myself.
Yeah, yeah.
Bodybuilders think, well, you know what? I can stand with Arnold. Like Mike Mensah. Mike Mensah was good, okay? Mm-hmm. He could never beat Arnold. The year in Australia, he may have been a little bit more complete than Arnold.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But, bodybuilding, which people don't understand, it's how you project yourself. Arnold would go on stage, and if there's 15 guys on stage, you would start left, your eyes would go to the right. You get to Arnold, your eyes would lock for a moment.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you'd go the rest of the way. He had something special. He knew how to stand. He knew how to pose. He knew always, you're never relaxed on stage. Even when you're called out and you go in the back, you never relax.
Yeah.
The point he gave me, and I always said, you know what, Arnold? He said, people always look at you. When you in the back, they look at you. Because when you come forward, everybody's pumped up with the lats, with the flexing. But when you in the back, when you relax, people look at you. And I said, this bitch is right.
Yeah.
How do you argue with 8-time Mr. Olympia?
Right, exactly. Arnold was always smart, right? Whether he was in the movies or bodybuilding or anything, yeah.
You saw how he intimidated Louis in Pumping Iron.
Oh, yeah. He had that charisma.
Come on. I mean, yeah. Let's be honest. You know, I tell people, Louis was good, but he can never be an Arnold. If they're both in shape, he can never be an Arnold.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, he had that presence on stage. He walk up on stage, you know, he just knew what to do. And people will look at him and go, there's the winner. There's the winner.
Yeah.
That guy may be second or third or fourth, but there's your winner.
Right.
I went to a competition in Holyoke, Massachusetts, which is a little small town up in Massachusetts. Arnold was a guest poser that came for that time. This is the first time I ever seen Arnold. I think it was like in, well, actually, I saw Arnold in 69. This was probably in 70 or 71.
Wow, when he was at his peak.
And he Ed Jubenville was a big guy in the AAU on the East Coast.
Yeah, I remember Ed Jubenville, yeah.
Arnold came out to do a guest posing, and Mike Katz was a big guy on the East Coast.
Uh-huh.
Which you would see him in Pumping Iron. Ken Sprague antagonized the shit out of him over a sweatshirt.
Ken Waller,
yeah. Well, I mean, Mike was, you know, he didn't really have a good body, but he had a like a barrel chest, just naturally, mm-hmm. big rib cage.
Yeah.
And, you know, he worked very hard to get his body up, but he was a long body, and the legs were, you know, weak. He had long arms. Arms didn't have a good bicep, but he would walk around, he'd hold his belly in, he would pump his chest up. And, you know, had that big barrel rib cage, and it looked like, wow, this guy, wow. But he really didn't have a lot of money.
Right.
But nevertheless, he was there with Arnold. And I remember those two standing side by side together. And when they both took their shirts off to do the posing exhibition, I went like, wait a second. This guy's good, Mike Katz. He's good for our area, but no way he could even compete with Arnold. Mm-hmm. He threw the double biceps up. It was over.
Yeah.
Side chest. It was over.
Yeah.
The most muscular, it was over. But Arnold, I mean, he just, you know, when he come around, everybody was like this. You knew this guy was special.
Yeah, yeah. He had that charisma. Yeah.
And, okay, I'm going to cut to the chase on something else. This was for my second Mr. America.
Yeah, in 78.
Yeah. I trained with, I think, not the best body, but aesthetically, if you had to look at a pretty body, this was the guy who I said I want to look like.
Mm-hmm.
Serge Nubray.
Yeah.
The black.
One of the greatest.
Panther or black leopard, whatever he's called.
Right.
Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful physique.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Skin was like ebony black. But his chest, his pecs, his delt, his abs, the tie-in. That one iconic pose where he has, which no one else can do, one mm-hmm. hand, left hand on the thigh, the right hand, you know that pose.
Yeah, yeah.
So many bodybuilders try to do it. As good as Robbie Robertson, couldn't do it. Frank Zane, anybody tries to do that pose, it's their iconic pose. Nobody can match that.
Right.
I trained with him for my second Mr. America, and he trained totally opposite of how I trained with Robbie.
Okay.
He never benched more than 225.
Mm-hmm.
But we did like 30 sets.
Wow.
And rest in between sets. I'm like, we got to go. And he looked at me, you know, because he spoke French, broken English. He would look at me and he put his hands like, relax, slow down. And I'm like, no, we got to go. We're like 2 minutes in between sets. We got to go. Relax. So I learned a lot from him, and there's a couple articles and magazines where him and I were at the counter in mm-hmm. Gold's Gym, the one on Second Street, and there's one picture that I have in my archives, which is in a lot of what Bob was in a couple of the magazines. Him and I, in between sets, were sitting on a bench. I have, he has a t-shirt on, I think a World Gym t-shirt with shorts. I have a sweat top on, and my sweatpants are rolled up to my knees, and my calves are like just blown out.
They were just I remember that picture. I remember those pictures, yeah.
And I'm standing next to Noubre, and he's got his hand, his elbow on his hip and relaxing. And I remember that day we're working calves, and I'm looking at him and saying to myself, Sergio, we got to fucking go. We got to – this relaxing stuff is not working. We got to go. We got
to superset.
Right. And he was like, relax, relax.
I heard his nutrition, too, was pretty wild, his diet.
Oh, he was
– much different.
Yeah, I don't know much about nutrition because after the gym, he would – he'd just go out. He was on – you know, he – Dan Lurie from Lurie Magazine, he was
– Yeah,
he was like,
yeah, muscle training,
like,
sir.
Yeah, yeah, he was Noubre like sponsor.
Okay.
So he'd bring Noubre to the gym, and they Noubre would train, and him and Noubre would, you know, go off and do whatever they did, or go to restaurants or whatever they did. But he was kind of a quiet type, didn't say much in the gym.
Yeah. You
know, just walk around, nice and easy, and you know, just train and go do his thing.
Yeah. So tell me about that 78 America. How'd you feel that went? Because you won the tall class again.
I won the tall class. I was in fairly good shape, but we were doing the Hulk, and we were working 16 hours a day.
Wow.
And I was trying to hang on because I wanted to win that competition overall. But to be quite honest, I wasn't 100%. I was good enough to get by the other heavyweight.
Yeah.
But Tony Pearson was young and up and coming. And everybody was, you know, a lack of calves. Because Tony really didn't have any calves.
Yeah.
He had a good upper body. He had great lats.
Yeah, great lats.
His arms were okay. He was muscular. Had good abs, good quads. And I think that I think he should have beat me. He was more complete than I was. I had more devastating body parts as individuals.
Mm-hmm.
But he was a little more complete than I was. Although my calves were just, you know, light years ahead of his. My arms were light years ahead of his. He had better lats than I did. I was muscular. He was muscular. He was up and coming. I was 100%. He was probably 100%. No excuses. Mm-hmm. He deserved to win that one. And I was okay with it.
How did you feel when he beat Ron Tufel? Because Ron Tufel took that really hard. He walked off stage, and it was like a real big upset.
Ron Tufel took it hard because he had lost to me the previous year. And he had made some great gains. And, I mean, aesthetically, on stage, Ronnie, I mean, he had great, you know, he had good, he was really tan. You know, nice skin color, nice skin tone.
Yeah.
His iconic pose was one hand behind the head, the left hand behind the head, the right hand behind the back.
Right.
And the twisting pose and bring the abs out.
Yeah, yeah.
That was his iconic pose, which nobody on stage. Nobody on stage could hang with that. Nobody could replicate that.
Mm-hmm.
But Ron's problem is he was a little blocky in the lower body. He didn't have good separation in the thighs, and he was a little narrow shouldered with little wider hips.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But he could hide those body parts by doing all the twisting kind of poses.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Double arm, straight forward, no twisting. Double arm, lock knee, double bicep. That's when those kind of poses hurt him.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
With Tony would just excel because those big sweeping lats would come out.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And bicep was good enough, and he had good enough taper between the shoulders and the narrow waist that, you know, he would start to really start separating himself between myself and Ron.
Mm-hmm. You thought Tony should have beat Ron then in that show?
I think Tony should have got the nod by a slim margin. By a slim margin, I would have put Tony ahead.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right after that show, they had the pose down for the Mr. Universe. Did you try out for that? Because I know Mike Metzger was the guy who represented the USA in the heavyweights.
I did not. I was done. I was done with that competition. My mind at that point was focusing on leaving competition and focusing on trying to become a professional stuntman and get into the movie business. I'm not giving any excuses. I could have went on for that, but I figured, well, if I lost to Tony Pearson that night, I probably would lose to him again for the Universe title.
Yeah.
I mean, but the thing is, a different set of judges saw it differently.
Yeah.
But I was okay with what happened. I won the heavyweight division. I was moving on.
Yeah. So tell me about the stuntman work. I mean, when you started that in 77, how did you like the whole movie business thing?
Well, I could say I had worked. My first one was Kentucky Fried Movie. I was around some stunt people and around the acting stuff. I had done a couple of bit parts in movies. Rodney Dangerfield movie, Back to School. I was a bouncer at the door.
Oh, okay.
I had a little taste of the film business, but nothing, with any depth. And then when they called me for The Incredible Hulk, the gentleman who was a stunt coordinator, Frank Orsatti, he pulled me aside. He said, look, I've been to a couple of competitions, and you're the guy. But, there's an issue with the color. So, I have a background with, cars. I used to race hot rod cars. I know how to paint, custom paint jobs and all that stuff. So I know that when you let's just say you paint a car, okay? Mm-hmm. And there's a primer coat, which everybody knows, you primer something before you paint it. So if you use, let's say, a base coat, a coat of paint that goes on before the final coat.
Okay.
So if you have, let's say, a gold, G-O-L-D base coat, then you have a red, R-E-D base coat, and you're going to put another color over the top of it. Let's just say blue.
Okay.
So you got a gold base coat with a blue top. You got a red base coat with a blue top. When those paint jobs are done, they're going to look different because the base coat enhances the top coat color.
Mm-hmm.
So by Ferrigno being white and me being black, maybe that base coat of green may be different. Follow me so far?
Yeah.
Well, they may have to adjust the color of the Hulk paint on my body compared to the same paint that they would use. Well, not paint, I call it paint, but makeup. They would have to adjust the color because the camera sees, the eye of the camera can pick up all the discrepancies in colors. So they may have to adjust the color of my makeup different. They would have to adjust the color of Lou's makeup. But nevertheless, we did a photo shoot. I had a wig put on. Then we put on a forehead piece, which is a rubber appliance, appliance on my nose, and we did a full makeup. We went out to the back lot of Universal Studios, and we did a little obstacle course, running and jumping and doing this. They did it with Lou. They put it on film. They did it with me. They put it on film. They came back a couple weeks later and said, you know what? The color. There's no issue. It's going to work.
Okay.
So just a little food for thought, because a lot of people don't know this. They just don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
right.
little things you may want to enhance or not. But anyway, that's the story. And then Frank Orsatti, the stunt coordinator, pulled me aside. And I said, look, here's the deal. I'm an athlete. I can run. I can jump. I'm flexible. I've got good speed. I've got good spring in my legs. I can do this. You just got to teach me the fine points of what we're going to do. He said, this is what you're going to be doing. Yada, yada, yada. You're going to be jumping off of a building into an airbag, 20, 30 feet. Because the Hulk, if you recall, the Hulk always saves the day.
Yeah, yeah,
the wife,
for sure.
The wife's being beat up by the husband. The Hulk goes, kick the husband's ass, take the wife, and jump out of the building to the road.
Right.
Somebody's being apprehended by whatever. The Hulk crashes through the wall, pick somebody up and takes off, run. So high falls were a lot of what we're doing, crashing through walls, crashing through glass windows, crashing through doors, taking guys and throwing them by the back of their collar 20 feet across the bar, picking guys, backhanding them, have them go with all different pieces of equipment to make that happen.
Right.
All that stuff, I was comfortable. He took me under his belt, taught me all the ropes. As the days went on, I learned a little bit more. He took me under his belt. Thought I had all the goods, taught me how to become a stunt coordinator, taught me how to break down scripts, taught me how to conduct production meetings, how to go scout locations, what to look for, all the different pieces of equipment to do what. So he took me under his belt, and that was probably one of the biggest things that could happen to me. It did happen to me in my life, was this man taking me under his wing and giving me a shot.
Unbelievable. Wow. So what does a stunt coordinator do compared to a stunt man?
Well, a stunt man generally is hired to either do doubling. You take an actor, 5'10", 165 pounds, blonde with blue hair, blue eyes with brown hair. So you try to find somebody, first of all, that matches that size and somebody that has the skills to do whatever that actor is supposed to do. Drive a car, be put on fire, jump out of a building, crash through a window, be hit by a car, ride a motorcycle, whatever. You find somebody that matches up, that has that skill level. And then the stunt coordinator gets a script, and the script says, well, let's say the guy's name is Bill. Bill walks into the bar, he gets in an argument with the bartender, and a fight happens. Those are very vague things. It's my job as a stunt coordinator to find somebody that's going to do the stunts for Bill, goes into the bar, and a fight happens. Well, what does that mean, a fight happens? I create what that fight happens means. So I create whatever Bill has a confrontation with the bartender, then a fight instills. The bartender grabs Bill, pulls him over the bar, picks him up, punches him. He falls over the table, hits a couple of other stunt people that are having drinks at the table. The beers go flying. The guys fall over the table. A fight instills with the other guys that are in the bar. I create all that.
Wow. So you're choreographing all the fights.
Choreograph whatever the fights, car chases, being put on, whatever the action is. I have to come up with the scenario and create all that so the actor, the director has an opportunity to see what that fight. Bill walks into the bar and a fight starts. I have to create that fight.
Wow.
And show the director until I usually have a couple of variations so the director can say, well, I like this fight. Or, you know what? I like that fight. But you know what? I like this part of the fight when the guy goes over the table, but I don't like him having the beer broken over his head. So I give him a couple of different options, and we come together for a final scene. And then we have a rehearsal where we do all the scenes without breaking the bottle over the head. We just simulate the punches and stuff, and the director signs on it. Now I've just created the fight in the bar. Or whatever, car chase. Car hits a tree and rolls over or tumbles down a hill into a ravine or whatever. I have to create all that as a stunt coordinator.
So now is this you've been doing this now for 40 years, right, Manny?
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. So has it really changed now with the advent of CGI and, you know, all the special effects? I'm sure in the 70s it had to be so much different than it is now in 2018.
Yeah, during the 70s everything was done real time. I mean, when a guy walked away from a building that was being blown up, we blew that building up.
Right.
Today we'll put you in front of a green screen, which is a big green piece of material. And then we'll have, there's one iconic shot where Danny Glover and Mel Gibson walking away from a building that explodes.
And Lethal Weapon,
One of the Lethal Weapons. Well, I can stand you in front of a green screen, and I can have your background. I can have that building. I can have that green screen be a building that's blowing up. I can have it be a tidal wave, a tsunami that's coming in. I could have it, a house falling on you. I could create whatever I want on that green screen and have you clear of any danger.
Yeah.
That's what green screen has taken away from some of the action. But nothing can replace human movement.
Right.
The reaction for someone going, okay, this building's going to blow up behind you, and roll camera, and someone goes, bang. That's a different reaction that you're going to see when someone is in front of a building and this building is blown up with dynamite.
Yeah.
It's a different reaction. You can't capture that.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
Yeah. So in that aspect, that CG has hurt the business in somewhat. And if you're jumping off of a building years ago, you would do, let's say you jump off a building. It was, let's say, 40 feet high.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you would actually take a stuntman. You would have multiple cameras. Why so many cameras? Because if one camera has a problem, the lighting wasn't correct, or the camera speed wasn't correct, or the film got clogged up in the camera. So you don't have to do it multiple times. You have multiple cameras. So one of those cameras is going to capture the full fall.
Yeah.
Now, today, with CG, I can put you 10 feet up, and you jump 10 feet into a pad. I can take that and stretch that, so you jump now 500 feet.
Oh, wow. Unbelievable.
They can do all that digitally, and then
yeah.
See you jump 10 feet, look like you jump 500 feet, or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. And the chance of injury has to be much, much less, right, today than it was.
And, yeah. Absolutely. But, you know, insurance companies love that because they can put Tom Cruise on the side of that, hanging off that chopper at 1,000 feet.
Mm-hmm.
They'll hang him off a chopper 5 feet on stage behind a green screen.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And there's the hero, Tom Cruise, who likes to boast and brag that he does all his stunts, which is he does some stuff, but insurance companies will not let him hang off a chopper at 1,000 feet.
No, I don't think they would. No,
no, because insurance. Yeah. I mean, if he goes down, the whole production goes down.
Yeah, the whole thing's going right. Yeah, I love seeing movies. I'm a big movie buff, and I almost enjoy now seeing a movie. You know, with all the advent of all the CGI and stuff, I almost enjoy when they have a basic fight scene between two guys. You know, and it's real, and it's, you know, and all the special effects is gone.
Old school.
Yeah, old school, yeah. Like there was a James Bond movie with Dave Bautista and Daniel Craig, and they were fighting in that train. You remember that? And it was it was a great scene because it was just real combat, close quarters, you know, just a real fight.
Yeah, absolutely. The real stuff.
Yeah. I know you've done a ton of movies. I'm looking at your IMBD here, and it says that you did like 224 stunts, I think, or you worked on 224 movies with the stunts. Is there any that are some of your favorites that stick out?
You know, there's so many. It's hard to pick them two out because they all. Movies with film, you have so much more latitude. You have bigger production. You have rehearsal time. You have multiple takes. Mm-hmm. With TV, you don't have that luxury with TV because you have to schedule. And, you know, you just don't have the budget. I mean, movies, you know, $100-$200 million, $250 million budget for the film.
Yeah.
Episodic TV. I mean, even today, TV, I mean, years ago, you could make a film for $3 million. You could do a film. Now, episodic TV, there's some episodes that are like $4-$6 million an episode.
Jeez, really? That's unbelievable.
Yeah, with all the stuff that they do. And so with film, it's hard to say which is, you know, I remember The Incredible Hulk the first time. I had to wing walk on a plane called a crop duster. It's a plane with like two wings, one over each other.
Sure, yeah.
Well, on The Incredible Hulk, we had a scene where Bixby is in the plane and he's chasing after somebody. He grabs onto the plane, the where the wheels are, grabs onto that as the plane takes off. So we just had Bill Bixby's stuntman. We cable him off and the plane takes off, and then when he takes off, he hangs off of it, and we bring the plane back, and he creeps back up, and the plane lands. Well, as the plane's in the air, Bixby hulks out, and then he jumps out of the fuselage onto the wing.
Okay.
So here I'm 1,500 feet up on the wing of a plane.
Wow.
And the prop on the front, the propeller, when that backwash comes off of that propeller, it enables the back, the two little baby wings on the back.
Uh-huh.
Well, the prop gusts off of that prop in the front enables the plane to stay up in the back. That's what keeps the back of it up.
Yeah.
So as I wing walk out onto this wing, and then we're full throttle, and we're up about 12 or 1,500 feet, now the plane is dipping in the back because the prop wash is not being totally picked up from a lot of that wind.
Right, right.
So the plane's going, I look at the pilot, he looks at me and gives me like, okay. So I'm like, fuck it, this is going down. We're all dying.
Yeah, right.
I don't mean to use those kind of words, but you know.
Yeah.
Wow. There, you know what I'm saying. I'm looking down. I'm looking 1,500 feet. I'm like, that's where I'm going to be in a minute and be dead.
Splatter on the ground.
But I mean, it was a moment, and I've done, you know, I've rolled a car over. I've been inside of a car, and we have a thing that's called a cannon, mm-hmm. which is basically, for layman's terms, it's like a giant shotgun shell that's welded into the frame of a car. You push a button in that shotgun shell, meaning the projectile that comes out.
Yeah.
Like a shotgun shell, a bullet comes out.
Well, right.
This is a slug of like a cutoff telephone pole that's stuffed up in there. You push a button and it ignites the pole to go down. It lifts the car up.
Wow. No kidding.
So you're driving down the street at 40 miles an hour. You hit the emergency brake and you start doing the skid. And you hit that button, that car is going to roll over, right?
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
And it rolls 6, 7, 8, 10 times. And depending on how big of a charge that you put that in, and you load up the cannon, depends how much you're going to roll or what speed or whatever. I remember my first cannon roll, I rolled about 7.5 times at 60 miles an hour.
Wow.
Better ride.
Yeah.
Better ride. Yeah.
Unbelievable. So you really had an amazing, amazing life and amazing career in the movies.
I'm proud of what I've done.
Yeah.
You know, coming to Hollywood, not knowing anyone, not having somebody say, "Here's my buddy, throw him a bone, give him a shot." I had to make my own bones, and I'm proud of what I've done. And you know, my family, I got my family, my son, my wife, my dad. They're all proud of Daddy. My wife says my husband's had three lives. You know, from being a bodybuilder, being working in the movies, and now I'm a director. I direct episodic TV and I got the Directors Guild, so I direct TV.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow, that's fantastic! I didn't know you were a director also.
Yeah, you look in the IMDb credits on the bottom, it'll say director, you see the stuff. And there's action units. When we do a film, and then you shoot a film, and there's big action scenes that we use the doubles and not the actors.
Mm-hmm.
We take the doubles, and we go shoot a car chase. It may take 3 or 4 days to do a car chase.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they're not going to do that with the filming of the film, or the filming of the first unit, because it's too time-consuming, too lengthy, and it's going to be with the doubles. So we take a separate, smaller unit, and we go off and do all the action, the doubles. And then I become a second unit action director.
Okay.
So that's where I get my directing on second unit, and then I direct also TV, and last year episode, I'm involved with a TV series called The Affair. It's a Showtime show.
Yeah.
They gave me an episode to direct with the actors last year. So first in the director, which is a big feather in the stuntman's cap to direct actors.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I watched that. I actually watched that show on Showtime.
Good show.
Yeah. Oh, that's fantastic. Man, you've had a really, you know, I talk to so many bodybuilders and you hear so many stories of the guys who came over to California like you did and tried to make it. And then they really just, they live that bodybuilding lifestyle for a while, and then a lot of them don't really do anything. But you really went on and had another whole different type of career in the movies. And like I said, it's been 40 years, so it's been, you know, it's a whole career for you.
Well, you know, typically I see a lot of bodybuilders. I don't want to talk bodybuilding down because I'm a realist. I look at stuff through a real realistic lens.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, bodybuilders typically a lot of them are not athletes. They're not popular with sports.
Mm-hmm.
They're not popular with the girls. They're not popular with the gang. They kind of they get into bodybuilding and lifting weights, and all of a sudden their body starts to grow and people start to take notice of them.
Yeah.
So now someone who's off to the side now becomes, hey, have you seen Billy in the last couple of years? Wow, he looks great. So they're getting a little recognition. They're getting a little notice. I mean, this is how I see it.
Yeah.
Now they're using bodybuilding. Wow, I found my niche.
Bodybuilding. Yeah.
And they go and they compete and they get into Gold's Gym, whatever. but they never have a real long-time goal or focus.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody that works out and competes, everybody wants to be a Mr. Universe. Some make it, some don't. Very few become Mr. Olympia.
Yeah.
But a lot of guys are going to have the thing, I'm going to become Mr. Olympia or bust. Well, mm-hmm. I hate to tell you, buddy, but you're going to probably bust.
Right.
And they never exactly. What am I going to do when I'm 40 years old and I have to hang up my trunks? What am I going to do?
Yeah.
Well, luckily, in the last 20 years or so, this whole personal trainer thing came around.
Mm-hmm.
And people that are no longer bodybuilders take on clients to be personal trainers.
Yeah.
But that's fine. But there's no real longevity with that because there's always somebody younger, bigger, stronger to come along. Mm-hmm. When you want to have a 27-year-old training you rather than a 60-year-old training you.
Yeah, yeah.
And you've got guys that never looked at, well, you know what? I maybe need to have something for a retirement.
Mm-hmm.
I need to have something for insurance, which everybody, you get older, things change, and you're not always going to be that 25-year-old guy that's got muscles bulging all over. You
yeah.
may have heart attack. You may have ulcers. You may have a stomach condition, or you may have cancer. You, God forbid, all these things, but mm-hmm. it's reality in life. It's reality.
Yeah. Yeah.
So my goal was, I wanted to be a top bodybuilder, but I wasn't going to, my son is not going to, the son is not going to set on me wearing posing trunks.
right.
I had a vision. I had a vision when I left Massachusetts to come to California. I wanted to be a top bodybuilder, and I wanted to probably get into film and TV. I didn't know how I was going to do that, but mm-hmm. that was my goal, and that's what the direction that I went to. And with a little bit of luck, in grace of God, I was able to achieve that.
Yeah, and you were smart enough to make that move at the right time when your opportunity came along.
Yeah. Well, I had to make that opportunity. A lot of guys I trained with, worked out with, before me, after me, with me, they are either personal trainers or they're working for a construction company, a bouncer at a bar, mm-hmm. or a driving truck. Or I didn't want that.
Yeah.
I didn't want it. Myself. Yeah. I'm going to give myself an opportunity to try to better myself. If I fail, that truck driving job, that construction job, that operating heavy equipment job, that's not going to be there.
Yeah.
That's not going anywhere.
Right.
But I'm going to give myself a shot to do something other.
Right. Well, Manny, I appreciate your time and talking to us. I loved hearing those stories about the golden era of bodybuilding. That was great stuff. And, I know you're a busy man, obviously, with your career and your job, and you're directing now, like you said. So I appreciate you taking some time to talk with us. Like I said, I grew up admiring your physique. You had an awesome physique, and congratulations on such a great career in the movies as a stunt coordinator and now a director. Thanks for taking the time to talk to us.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time and wanting to spend a little time with me and my journey. For me, old school bodybuilding is the only school for bodybuilding. I love the guys today. I think they're great. You know, the guys that won the Olympia today, I think they're great. But mm-hmm. it's different from the days that we were in the gym at the original Gold Gym. It's just a different time, which is fine.
I agree.
We had our day, and they're having their day today.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you very much for the time. I appreciate chatting with you and sharing my experience. I appreciate you taking the time, and God bless.
All right. Thanks, Manny. Take care now.
Yes, sir.
Bye. Bye-bye. All right. Thank you for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I want to thank our sponsors, Old School Labs and Florida Alternative Medicine, for sponsoring this episode. And also thanks to Manuel Perry for such a great interview. We will be back next week, so we will see you then. Take care.